It's 8:19. You're listening to Morning Edition on KASU Jonesboro, 91.9 FM. I'm Mark Smith. Joining me by phone this morning is Arkansas 1st District Representative Rick Crawford. Good morning.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Doing well. Let's start off today with some important issues for Arkansas. We've heard the story from Consumer Reports about arsenic levels in rice products. Now, this is bound to be a concern for people, especially parents feeding rice cereals to their kids. Is there cause for concern?
I don't think so. I think that since 1991, the FDA has been involved in testing for arsenic in a variety of foods. That includes rice. It also includes things like juices. And, you know, they take a science-based, risk-based approach in order to minimize the risk in food supply from contaminants. But after looking at the actual research, the FDA said there's not enough scientific data to show a relationship between those who consume higher levels of rice and rice products and the type of illnesses associated with arsenic. So, and the FDA testing produced the same results as Consumer Reports, but again, the evidence is not conclusive enough to make recommendations for a change in your diet.
Well, I'll be clear, the Consumer Reports article, the report there said that it was just trying to make people aware of a possible greater risk from this arsenic exposure over a lifetime of increased exposure, and they were just calling for some stricter regulations on arsenic levels in food products. Is this something we need to look at?
Well, you know, arsenic is a naturally occurring element in the air and water, in the soil, and it's always been in the food supply to some extent, and it occurs naturally in a lot of healthy foods. So we don't use any arsenical pesticides when we're growing rice in the United States, and so I don't think there's any greater risk in eating rice than there would be in eating any other particular food. And, you know, certainly we support, a continued diligence to make sure that we don't run into problems, but I don't know that it's necessary that we increase or step up that testing beyond what we already have.
Well, while we're talking about farm products, the current farm bill is expiring, and we do not have a new farm bill yet. Why not?
Well, you know, unfortunately, this is I came out of the House Ag Committee markup after we finished the farm bill in the House, and pretty encouraged because it passed on a 35-11 vote. And, you know, in this environment, that's about as bipartisan as you get. And, of course, you know, the Ag Committee has historically been very very bipartisan. And so, you know, a little bit disappointing that leadership on both sides has really not had an interest in taking up the farm bill. Now, we've got some on one side that say we're not spending enough, and on the other side we're spending too much. And so the real disconnect has come with nutrition title of the farm bill, which, you know, the truth of the matter is the farm bill nutrition title is about 80% of the total farm bill. So having a disconnect there is really a pretty big deal. But I think when we get a 35-11 vote and the nutrition title in the markup reflected a $16.5 billion cut in programs like food stamps, for example, I think that we saw a willingness to kind of meet in the middle. We had some folks that wanted to cut as much as $40 billion out, and then we had others that said, no, not only do we want to not cut, we want to plus it up. And so the truth of the matter is, in this budget environment that we have right now, it was a responsible approach to essentially close the loopholes that are costing taxpayers more money, and what we're seeing in the nutrition title was addressing the savings that we could achieve through closing a whole lot of the loopholes, which I would also remind folks that Arkansas would not be affected at all because Arkansas has done a good job in administering that federal program, the federal nutrition programs, and so the loopholes in Arkansas weren't present, weren't being exploited, but what we saw is in real large urban centers that it was a prevalent problem that we had to deal with, and in dealing with that, arrived at a $16.5 billion cut, and it's really not really as much of a cut as it is a savings.
Uh-huh. I understand you've been pushing for this farm bill, of course, and what have you been doing to try to get this done?
Well, you know, immediately after the House Ag Committee passed our farm bill in July 1st, I signed a letter to leadership asking them to hold a vote on the farm bill, and we had 79 signatures on that letter. And then we came home for the August research recess. I held a farm tour in the district, and we, I can't tell you how many farms we went to, but in a five-day period, probably in the 10 or 12 farms and farming operations, field days, and so on. So it was jam-packed. And, you know, I've written since July, I've written a whole lot of op-eds about the need to pass the farm bill. I've spoken on the House floor about the need to pass the farm bill. And then finally, last week, I signed a discharge petition that would force a vote on the farm bill and kind of trying to help lead the signature gathering effort on that. So, you know, we have been steadily beating the drum for the need for a farm bill.
Of course, election year politics seems to seem to enter into everything. I've seen the accusation by some Democrats and Democratic supporters that Republicans are blocking the farm bill over issues like you're talking about, like the food stamp program.
Well, I don't know that that's necessarily accurate. I think there's as many people blocking the farm bill for their own reasons on both sides. For example, as I said before, you know, there's some folks on the other side that want to spend more. Not only do they not want to cut or try to make recognize or realize any savings in those programs, they want to spend more on them. And so there's a real disconnect. And then we have some on the other side that want to cut as much as $40 billion, and I don't think that's realistic either. But I think what we've done and what was reflected in this farm bill, a bipartisan effort, 35 to 11 votes said yes on a $16.5 billion cut over a 10-year period. And I think that's about as responsible of an approach as we can take, and that's about as solid a bipartisan effort as you can expect. So I think what that did was it should be set an example for the rest of our members of the House to follow and say, you know, we've been able to overcome our partisan differences in the House Ag Committee. We certainly ought to be able to do the same thing on the House floor.
Well, we're getting some more rain this morning here in Northeast Arkansas, but of course we had this summer of terrible, terrible drought, and emergency assistance for farmers was passing through Congress. But even that issue, which seemed to be a pressing need, was a contentious one.
Well, it was. We were able to get it through the House, and unfortunately, if we don't have a willing partner in the Senate, then it may never see the light of day, and that's essentially what happened is that we sent it to the House, or sent it to the Senate, and, you know, they declined to take that up. And so while we're trying to do the work of trying to provide some relief to farmers, the Senate would, you know, I guess would just soon ignore that pressing need. Two-thirds of the country is in a, you know, record drought scenario, and I think it would be only responsible that they take up that House measure to provide some relief.
Well, there are a lot of farm issues being discussed in the halls of Congress now. I noticed on the Senate side, Senator Pryor's co-sponsoring a bill to exempt small farms from some EPA regulations regarding fuel storage.
Right. We passed that bill back in July out of transportation, and basically it's the same bill. And he and Senator Inhofe have introduced that so that we could get that through the Senate and hopefully provide some relief by the end of the year. It passed out of committee without a single no vote, and it passed off the House floor without a single no vote. So, again, a very good bipartisan effort. We had a whole lot of co-sponsors from both sides on that bill, and the University of Arkansas studied my bill, and they said it would save Arkansas farmers alone $240 million, and further, the entire country would realize a savings of $3.36 billion. And so at a time when we've got the opportunity to provide some regulatory relief to farmers, this is certainly one of those bills that we're excited about. And so I'm happy to hear that Senator Pryor and Senator Inhofe are moving that through the Senate, and hopefully we'll get it done.
There seems to be some bipartisan agreement there, at least.
Absolutely.
The farm bill, of course, we've talked about, is a big budget item. And on budget matters, Congress has faced the not unusual task of passing a continuing resolution to fund the government for another 6 months while they continue to wrangle over appropriations bills.
Right. And again, what we found is that as important as bipartisanship is, it's equally important to try and achieve a level of bicameralship, if you will, and that is that we have to have somebody in the Senate that's willing, and we have to have members over there that are pragmatic in their approach. And so that CR is being held up right now over on the Senate side, and hopefully cooler heads will prevail and we'll get that done and be able to fund the government for the balance of the fiscal year.
One thing that seemed likely to get done in the Senate has actually shocked a lot of people in the way it's turned out, a bipartisan veteran job corps bill,
right,
designed to help veterans get back into the workforce, has been killed in the Senate. And Republican senators, including Senator Bozeman, have been accused of killing it for political reasons. I'd like to get your perspective on this as a Republican and as a veteran.
Well, you know, and I can bring that perspective to bear in both counts. I mean, being a veteran and being a Republican in the House, what I can't do is speculate on the motivation of what's going on in the Senate.
Sure.
So I wouldn't attempt that, but I would like to say that certainly I appreciate every man and woman who's ever served in uniform, and you know, my dad, all of my uncles, both of my brothers. I mean, my family has a long history of serving in the military, and from World War II to Afghanistan. I mean, it's very, very important to recognize. But earlier in the year, the House passed the Veteran Skills to Jobs Act that was intended to address the inordinately high rate of veterans' unemployment by streamlining federal certification processes and essentially cutting through the bureaucratic red tape, making it easier for veterans to utilize the skills that they acquired in the military and help them secure a job. So rather than going through the process of redundant training for jobs that they're already qualified for, veterans that have relevant training could be eligible immediately to receive a federal license and get back to work immediately. So we passed that with good bipartisan support out of the House, and again, we see that stalled in the Senate. And what the motives are, I can't speculate on, but we really would like to see that move over there.
Well, what's disturbing for a lot of people is it seems that some of the Republican senators were actually involved in the process of writing the bill and then voted against it.
Well, yeah, again, you know, we've seen that happen before on both sides, and I'm not sure exactly how things work over in the Senate. I know that they have their own set of rules, and they follow their own procedure, and sometimes it's a little confusing to us in the House, and sometimes that makes it a little more difficult to work with them. But, again, not questioning any of their motives, but just kind of, you know, wondering what's driving that decision-making process there, and we really would like to see some things move a little more aggressively through the Senate.
Well, you, of course, are up for re-election this year. You think it's going to be a tough race?
Well, we're going to assume that it is, and we're going to work as though it is, and so we're not leaving anything to chance, and we're just going to keep our heads down and drive on.
You have a Democratic opponent, of course, also a Green Party and, I believe, a Libertarian opponent. Do you think these other party opponents could have an impact on the race?
Sure. I mean, I don't know why not. They there are some folks on both sides that may be a little more liberal or a little more conservative in their approach. And so, you know, sometimes that's going to be reflected by the individuals on the ticket. So I would think that there would be at least some level of support for that type of view.
Now, maybe this may be just me, but it seems like it's been kind of an unusual race to me. It seems very like a very quiet race. I haven't seen a whole lot of stump speeches, a whole lot of rallies, or a lot of trash talking, or a lot of campaigning. I've seen a few signs here and there for either candidate, but for overall, it's been pretty quiet, it seems like.
Well, and that, you know, in comparison to the first time around, I think that's probably an accurate observation. But a lot of that has to do with it not being an open seat,
right?
And so there's probably not as much noise and there's not as much hype involved in this one as there was last time around. So that may have something to do with it.
Well, you've made some public appearances, but it doesn't seem like you've made really any more than you would make just as a congressman in a non-election year.
Well, you know, we have a pretty busy schedule. We cover a lot of ground, and that's been the case from day one. We've been very aggressive in reaching out to our constituents and being present at as many events as we can, and so we've just kind of maintained that pace. And so, but it does keep us busy.
We're watching the presidential race as well very closely. The presidential campaign winds seem to continue to be shifting. There's this latest Romney video where Mitt Romney appears to talk about 47% of Americans that don't pay federal income tax. He's been very widely accused of not caring about these people, and appears to a lot of people to have said that he doesn't care. I've seen this referred to as a game changer, but then there are those who are so firmly in the Republican camp, they're not going to change their minds, and then also those who are firmly in the anyone but Obama camp who may not change their minds. So I'm not sure how much of a game changer it is. What do you think?
Well, you know, you're probably right. I think it may be somewhat of a tempest in a teapot. I don't think he was given his due in context there. I think it wasn't that he was dismissing 47% of the people. I think what he was doing was recognizing that, in an election like this, there are probably going to be roughly 47% of the people that the president has a head start with. And so it's going to be incumbent on Governor Romney to put a lot of focus on the 53% in order to get over the top, and I don't think it was his intention, nor was it the context to dismiss 47% of the electorate out of hand. I think that it was probably overblown, and in fact, there's some evidence now coming out that the video was adulterated. So we may not know exactly what the full extent of that video and what the transcript might reveal.
Well, we're out of time. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for talking with us.
You bet. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Congressman Rick Crawford joining us from his office in Washington. You're listening to Morning Edition.